Good afternoon. Thanks for being with us. It's midday, and I'm Tom Hall, and we appreciate your tuning in today. To win his most recent political victory, President Trump insisted that his entire domestic agenda be crammed into one big, beautiful bill, as he refers to it. New work requirements for Medicaid and SNAP benefits, new funding for border security, an increase in defense spending and cuts to clean energy programs were paired with extending the tax cuts that were passed during his first term. Trump played chicken with the Republican caucus in Congress, and he won. No Democrats voted for the package, leaving it to Republicans to vote for a bill that increased the deficit by more than $3 trillion and decimated programs that are popular with many of their constituents, because a no vote would have been construed as a vote for higher taxes. So we begin today with a conversation about what the bill means for our state and for the rest of the country. My guest is Julie Margetta Morgan. She's the president of the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank founded back in 1919, makes it one of the oldest public policy research institutes in the country. Julie Margetta Morgan joins us on Zoom. It's good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So you've said that the cuts to Medicaid, which are pretty substantial, what they're referring to as cuts to Medicaid, are just the tip of the iceberg. What do you mean by that?
These cuts to Medicaid really have gotten a lot of attention from the public, but there are a ton of other little pieces, you know, tucked into this massive package that cut into families' cost of living. So, you know, obviously more than, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Maryland are going to lose access to Medicaid due to the red tape and work requirements in the bill, but more than 300,000 people in Maryland are going to lose food assistance as well. And then rolling back provisions of the ACA, which provides healthcare to many more Americans, is going to make healthcare plans much more expensive for families. There are changes to the student loan program that are going to make loans for college more expensive. And I think it's also really important to remember that it's not just this Republican mega bill that's that Donald Trump has been working on to hurt working families. You know, on the same day that the Republicans were working to pass this bill, Donald Trump also announced that he's going to cut salaries for home health care workers. They're imposing punitive collections measures on student loans while letting student loan servicers run wild. So truly, the Medicaid cuts are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the impact we're seeing on working families.
So the administration says that there are no cuts to Medicaid. The president promised that there'd be no cuts to Medicare or Medicaid. And the administration and the Republicans who support the legislation assert that it protects and strengthens Medicaid for the people who really rely on it, pregnant women, children, seniors, people with disabilities, and it eliminates waste, fraud, and abuse. So when we talk about cutting Medicaid, they're saying that it doesn't really do that, but by strengthening the requirements to be eligible for it, it will somehow save money. How do you understand their argument that says this will save money in Medicaid by, I mean, Medicaid, you only pay the money if you use this, healthcare services. So how does it save money?
Here's the way I understand this problem. So the problem facing Republicans here was that they wanted to create a massive giveaway for the wealthiest Americans. And they wanted to do that by spending as little money as possible. And so the way to do that was to cut back on other government programs. And, you know, they've tied themselves into knots trying to, like, explain away cuts as not cuts. But we have official experts who keep the score on how the changes that they're making are going to affect families in this country. And those official experts showed that there are cuts here, right? There are people who are going to lose access to their healthcare, to their Pell Grants to send their kids to college. And to many other services based on this bill. And you know, the mechanisms can be different, right? Some of the mechanisms are quite direct, like the work requirements embedded in the bill will cut back on access to healthcare for people who don't work. But there are also red tape requirements embedded in those Medicaid provisions that are predicted to cut many other people off. So these are people who ought to be eligible for Medicaid, who the experts are predicting will not get access to those services because of the red tape embedded in this bill.
So every 6 months, people are going to have to prove their eligibility for Medicaid. And one of the ways they're going to have to prove it is to show that they have been working, I think it's a minimum of 80 hours a month, or volunteering or going to school. There are a number of things you can do to satisfy the requirements. But as I understand it, the states and local jurisdictions who administer the Medicaid program are in charge of keeping track of these eligibility, this eligibility paperwork, of which there's going to be a lot, and they are receiving no extra money or no, extra administrative assistance to take care of that. Is that how you understand it as well? I mean, as a practical issue, implementing this seems to me is going to be very complicated and very difficult to do.
That's exactly right. And we don't have to guess, right? Because there are states that have implemented work requirements in the past, and the reviews of those programs have shown that they don't work, right? They don't cut off the people who are supposed to be cut off. They do cut off people who should not be cut off. They cost the programs, the states who administer those programs, a ton of money. You know, really the only people who win there are the consultants who help to administer these work requirements on behalf of the states. And you know, I think it's important to really understand this piece about the strain that this budget bill puts on state budgets, because it's not just the work requirements, the Medicaid changes, the changes to food assistance, the changes to education programs are going to put strain on state budgets. And we're going to see that come out in other places. You know, what we've seen in the past is that every time state budgets take a hit in order to cover healthcare or other big costers for the state, the first place we see those cuts is in state funding for higher education. So, you know, not only can you expect your healthcare and your food costs to go up and your utilities costs to go up here, you can honestly reasonably expect that tuition at your public universities will go up as well.
Julie Margetta Morgan joins us. She is the president of the Century Foundation. We're talking about the implications for the new bill, the reconciliation bill that the president refers to as the One Big Beautiful Bill. It's now no longer a bill, it's a law. And if you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join us. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. So, Julie, I've heard estimates from one guy here in Baltimore who is affiliated with a company that administers Medicaid benefits for the state of Maryland. He said that about 85% of people who are on Medicaid currently are already working, so that it's a small percentage, about 15% by his reckoning, that are not working, and many of those people can't work because of disabilities or whatever reasons. I've heard estimates as high as 93 or 94% of people on Medicaid are already working at least part-time. What's your understanding of the number of people that may be targeted in this effort to get rid of waste and fraud and abuse in the Medicaid program? How many folks are we talking about who aren't working, who could work as a condition of receiving Medicaid?
You know, I think the number of people who aren't working who could work is exceedingly small, but the number of people who are going to be affected by this bill is quite large. There are millions of people who will be kicked off of Medicaid because of this budget bill. And I think, you know, I think the way I think about this is just we have busy lives, right? We're dealing with our children, we're dealing with our work, we're dealing with, you know, taking our kids to the doctor and the challenges with our healthcare system overall. The odds of people falling through the cracks on those requirements every 6 months are quite high, right? And you know, anyone who's interacted with the federal student loan system knows the challenges of interacting with a contractor who's running a government program. I think we can expect that these programs will not be implemented in a smooth way that makes it easy for families to navigate.
There's a doctor in rural North Carolina who was interviewed by The Daily at the New York Times. It was posted just this morning. And she ran the Medicaid program in North Carolina, and she's now practicing medicine in a rural area, western part of the state. And she says that the bulk of waste and fraud, and there is some waste and fraud to be sure in the Medicaid program, but the bulk of it comes from doctors and the healthcare infrastructure itself. Doctors who are either mistakenly or fraudulently billing Medicaid for services that aren't delivered, etc. The Centers for Medicaid Services or Medicare Services has this thing called the Payment Error Rate Measurement, the PERM program. And they say that in 2024, there were improper payments about 5% of the time, which adds up to about $31 billion in federal funds. And other people, this thing called the Paragon Health Institute suggests that by dint of improper payments and eligibility errors, could be twice that. That estimate, in some fashion, reaches as much as $1.1 trillion over the last 10 years in fraud. So there's no doubt that there is some fraud happening. We see news reports when it's unearthed all the time. But do you have a sense, and do the folks at the Century Foundation with whom you're working have a sense of the scope of that problem? And is there anything in this bill that helps regulators or the government crack down on that part of the wasteful expenditures?
If the Trump administration were interested in taking on waste, fraud, and abuse, there are a lot of places that they could look. And, you know, some of them are in the healthcare space, but some of them are in other areas as well. And my concern is that we've actually seen them dial back on the cops on the beat who would actually help look at waste, fraud, and abuse. So in the healthcare sector, you know, I spent much of my time in the Biden administration working on medical debt, where we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of complaints from everyday Americans who were being charged for medical debts that they shouldn't owe, in part because they should have been covered by programs like Medicaid or by private health insurance. And, you know, the debt collectors were able to just lean on people until they paid these debts they didn't owe by threatening to put the debts onto their credit reports. The Trump administration is actually working to dial back the work that the Biden administration did to protect people from this coercive use of credit reporting to make people pay medical debts they didn't owe. You know, in other areas, the Trump administration has cut the staff who oversee contractors and make sure they're not engaging in waste, fraud, and abuse. So there are certainly areas where they could be acting, but the idea that this bill targets waste, fraud, and abuse is silly. What this bill does is transfer wealth from ordinary American families into the pockets of the wealthiest Americans.
And how do these cuts affect hospitals in particular? We hear a lot about rural hospitals who are bracing for very difficult times ahead because of the provisions in this bill, some thinking that they may have to close altogether. Can you explain the mechanics of that? Why would a rural hospital or any hospital be negatively affected by the provisions in this legislation?
Yeah, hospitals that serve populations that have the lowest incomes, that are the most likely to either benefit from Medicaid or to benefit from the health insurance programs that are going to become so much more expensive under this budget bill, are really going to struggle to figure out how to account for those losses in revenue. And, you know, when you talk to doctors in these areas, they're really faced with this challenge of keeping their clinics or their hospitals open, you know, while also making sure they can serve the population who they're intended to serve. My biggest concern here is, you know, both that the hospitals will struggle to stay open, but also that what we see when hospitals are facing those kinds of budget shortages is that they become targets for financial institutions who swoop in and say, "Have I got a solution for you? Just offer this credit card to your patients, get them to sign up before they even receive the services, tell them the credit card is at zero interest, and it's a win-win-win for everyone." You know, what we found at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is that those cards look like they're zero interest on the way in, but in fact, they cost people upwards of 30% interest and make it incredibly, incredibly expensive for people to afford their care. So I'm concerned both about closures, but also about hospitals finding these ways to keep their doors open that are actually much, much more expensive for their patients.
What about people who are here in the country without legal status? If you're a migrant, even if you're working, you're paying income tax, you're paying into Social Security, into Medicare for that matter. And we hear a lot about people doing this without any prospect of collecting those benefits when they're older because they're not here with legal status. And the administration would say that this legislation removes people without legal status from programs like Medicaid and SNAP. What's the argument for keeping undocumented people on those programs?
Well, I think it's just as you said, these people are contributing to our economy, they're contributing to our society and to our communities. And, you know, for many, many years, we've offered these benefits to people who are working for them. The provisions in this bill, and you named a few, but there are others, are really just, you know, one more step in the Trump administration's efforts to terrorize immigrant populations in this country, regardless of their legal status.
And if they are uninsured and they are very sick, if they seek out medical help, if they seek out health care services, they're going to end up in emergency rooms, right? And that's another strain on hospitals, many of which are required to treat people regardless of whether or not they have insurance. So there's a potential cost to hospitals and costs to wait times in emergency rooms, et cetera, because we have uninsured people going to the emergency room for things that could be handled, you know, through a program like Medicaid.
That's right. It's a huge strain on our healthcare system. And, you know, I mean, we didn't have a perfect healthcare system in this country before this bill, but this bill takes a number of steps with both intended and unintended consequences that are going to decrease the quality of care for all of us and increase the price for so many.
How does it impact people with private insurance? If your employer, you know, provides insurance to you and your family, why should people care about what's happening to people, who need to rely on Medicaid?
So this bill is going to increase the cost of private insurance across the board. I think one of the provisions that's going, or one of the decisions made in the bill that's going kind of underreported, is the decision not to extend tax credits for those who get their health insurance through the healthcare exchanges, through the Affordable Care Act. For those people, even though they're purchasing private insurance, insurance companies are estimating that there's going to be an average of a 17% increase in the cost of their insurance. And the Century Foundation has done some work to estimate in states and counties the impact of this decision, and it's quite a bit more depending on where you live.
Is there one, you know, sort of salient thing about this legislation you know, that strikes you as the worst part of it? There, you know, there's a number of people, the Democratic Party, to be sure, although they were feckless in their attempts to stop it, are saying that it's a terrible bill, and there are a number of experts who are weighing in, you know, like you've been weighing in today. But is there sort of one thing that stands out to you as a really egregious and onerous provision?
You know, I mean, I just think it's so hard to pick out one particular provision because the true evil, I think, of this bill and of what we're seeing from the Trump administration across the board is that they're just kind of powering this full-on assault on people who are trying to make an honest living. And it's almost So aggressive and of an assault that it's impossible to do the math on all of the ways that it's going to affect your life. So it's kind of like, the frog in the pot with the water boiling, what we're going to see rolling out over months and years to come is it getting a little bit more expensive and a little bit harder to live in the United States for so many people. And it'll be so far away from the passage of this bill that people might not even remember how they got there. They're just going to be feeling those really difficult effects.
There are those who point to the changes to the tax provisions, saying that it lowers the marginal tax rates, including for middle class and lower income tax filers. The standard deduction is boosted. The child tax credit goes up substantially from $200 to $2,200. There's an inheritance and gift tax exemption. Again, that's obviously something that's going to be much more significant for higher income individuals. It goes from 15 million to 30 million for couples. But are there parts of this tax provision? I mean, if the tax provisions had been let to expire as they're scheduled to do in just a few months, would it is is there credence to the argument that says this would have been end up being pretty expensive for middle class and lower income folks who are paying taxes?
The numbers really just don't bear that out. So each year, this bill is going to cost the poorest families an average of $560, and it's going to give away more than $118,000 to those at the top. So the idea that this bill is saving money for people across the income spectrum just isn't true. I think the other thing to think about is, which tax credits got extended and for how long, and who's getting tax benefits and for how long. So, like I said, the tax credits for that help people pay their health insurance premiums did not get extended. But even the pieces that the Trump administration has really touted as helping working families, including the provisions around taxation of tips, really don't last that long. Those were really just, kind of a red herring to make people feel like they're getting something out of this bill.
Yeah, the overtime taxes, the no tax on tips, those all expire in 2028, so just a few years. But the other tax provisions in the bill are now made permanent, and it's going to be very difficult, if not downright impossible, it seems to me, to reverse this. Right? I mean, is the Democrats' only argument, look, we need to raise taxes on the wealthy? They tried that in the last election. And Mr. Trump won that election. What do you see as the best argument for the political left to make in opposition to this approach to taxes, which, of course, as we always hear, when there are tax cuts, this is supposed to spur the economy and, increase growth. Whether or not that's ever happened is another matter of discussion. But what do you see as the Democrats' best argument to counter the kinds of provisions that are in this legislation?
Well, I think the experts that keep an eye on this stuff, like the Century Foundation, really need to have a close eye on cost of living and how kind of the sum total of these changes are affecting everyday Americans' lives. And, that's going to show up in the direct costs of programs like healthcare, and the cost of college, but it's also going to show up in terms of debt. So we're going to see people with higher credit card debt, with buy now pay later loans that they can't pay back, with student loans and auto loans and all of these other forms of debt. And then I think, we need to take a step back and assess what are the best ways to solve those problems for people? And some of that may be rebuilding a little bit of what the Trump administration has torn down, but I think there are some openings for, really building something bolder, that more directly addresses people's problems, than some of the programs we have right now.
Julie Margetta Morgan is the president of the Century Foundation. Thanks so much, Julie. I appreciate your perspective and hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you.
And coming up, reimagining Baltimore's waterfront promenade. We'll talk about some ideas that have worked in other cities to attract more people to downtown. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.